Hi, and welcome to Five Compelling Questions with Sean. This is the podcast where we speak with writers about writing. And I have a bit of a different kind of guest today, and I am just so thrilled that Matt Singer had time to talk to me today. I talked to a lot of novelists, but I'm really excited to talk to a different kind of writer today about a subject that we are both very passionate about. Welcome to the show, Matt Singer.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be here. And yes, not talk about a novel because I have never written and likely will never write one of those. But that's okay. It's fine.
That is okay. And we're thrilled that we need to. I love variety and inclusion. And we're happy to have a member of a journalistic. We've had other journalists on the show, so it's not, you're not the first one, but it is kind of a palate cleanser when we do have. Really quick, Matt Singer is the editor and film critic of ScreenCrush.com. And a member of the New York Film Critics Circle. In 2011, he won a Webby Award for his work on IFC News podcasts. He is the author of Marvel's Spider-Man From Amazing to Spectacular and lives in Brooklyn with his wife and two daughters. And I feel like there's like 500 other things we could say in that bio, but that is the short one. You come to us today with your newest, it is your newest book, Opposable Thumbs, yes?
Yes, that's it. That's the title.
All right. And I know what it's about, but can you tell everyone, what is this book about?
Sure. It is about Siskel and Ebert. Those are the thumbs of the titular thumbs, I suppose someone might say. And it is about their lives, their relationship, their TV show, and their influence on the world of movies, television, film criticism, popular culture in general. And that's the basic nuts and bolts. That's what it's about.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I came across this, when this was, you were offered to me as a guest, I just like sort of freaked out because I'm a Gen X person. So I remember it was like Fridays around the 6 o'clock-ish time, whatever it was, every weekend, you just watched, this is what we watched. We watched the show. We watched Siskel and Ebert at the movies. And it was sort of set the tone for what the weekend was going to be like because we went to the movies basically every weekend.
Right.
And I loved it. Yeah, it was like Rolling Stone, Entertainment Weekly, TV Guide, Siskel and Ebert. That's one of the things. So it is so cool that you wrote this. And, there were so many. I mean, I remember as a young person remembering something about them not getting along and all. There was like this drama behind the show. And I mean, it like their arguments were so interesting to listen to. And I mean, I had friends that were like, well, I always liked Ebert picks. And, it was like Team Ebert or Team Siskel. So tell me why you decided to delve into this whole world and write this book.
Well, sounds like you, I grew up a huge fan of this show. You were fortunate in that it was on by you at like 6 o'clock, you said, on Fridays, which is really like the ideal time for that show to be on because it's talking about the weekend's movies and you could kind of go, oh, that looks good. I should go see that this weekend or something like that. But it was, by the time I was alive and watching it, it was a syndicated show, which meant they really didn't have a ton of control over where it was placed on the TV schedule. And so I was growing up in suburban New Jersey, and, when I was really becoming obsessed with the show, it was on at odd hours, not ideal. You know, they didn't get primetime slots. And a lot of times it was like late at night, Sundays at midnight is the time slot I really remember it being and struggling with, because that was this. I'm talking about being like 13 years old, and I am not supposed to be awake at that time of night. I'm supposed to be asleep. So I would say good night, mom and dad, and I'm going to sleep now. And I would turn off the lights in my room and lay silently in the dark, but awake, and hope that my parents would go to sleep themselves, or at least, go to bed and be distracted enough and not listening that I could, when 12 o'clock rolled around, I could turn on the TV at the lowest possible volume and watch the show. And so like where the book started was really that moment of borderline deranged obsession, I suppose you could say, was that I really did love the show, and it absolutely was the first thing that inspired me to get into the world of movies and film criticism. And so, yeah, I mean, I've always wanted to read a book about them. And so it did not exist. And so it didn't, if I wanted to read it, I was going to have to write it, I suppose, at a certain point. And so here we are.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad that you did. I mean, it's definitely, I'm glad it's out in the world and that everyone can enjoy it, because it's a phenomenon. And it was one of the first ones, one of the first things where you could actually watch and listen to someone critique a movie. that I remember. I dated myself because, you know, I'm very proud Gen X person. We were the first to do a lot of things, you know. I'm 52, but I definitely remember that was it. It was just like, here's the lunch of the weekend. We're going to do this. And I grew up in South Florida, and we, you know, maybe it's because there's a lot of older people down there. We like, they wanted to see it earlier in the night, but and I was, I feel like we could be really good friends because I used to tape David Letterman and watch it when I got home from school because I was definitely not allowed to stay up that late. Definitely not every night. So I would just tape it on like a VHS tape and I would watch Nerd Alert. I would do that every single day.
And Gene and Roger were frequent guests on that show. They were some of his best guests. In fact, there's a whole chapter in the book about their appearances on talk shows. But if you had to pick only one show that you know, they kind of had the most appearances, the best appearances on, for sure, it would be Late Night and then Late Show with David Letterman. I mean, and he would often say that they were amongst his favorite guests. That he liked, somewhat jokingly, but maybe not entirely jokingly, liked to think of himself as the third Siskel and Ebert. And that the reason that the show, if you remember, had two chairs on the set was because of Siskel and Ebert. Like, there really wasn't another reason, because, you know, unlike The Tonight Show, where people would sit on the couch and move down the whole show, that wasn't really how The Letterman Show worked. You would come out, you'd do your thing, and you'd leave. And very rarely did they have two people on, except for Siskel and Ebert. So, you know, when I that was a story I had heard, and I interviewed a couple of different people who worked on the Letterman shows as producers, executive producers, and said, is that a true story? And they were like, yeah, it kind of was, because we really didn't have other multiple people guests. It really was Siskel and Ebert. They were the ones they were the only ones who actually used the second chair that was out there. So it's certainly one of the biggest reasons why that show had two chairs was Siskel and Ebert.
That's awesome. That is so cool. Yeah, it's not like Sonny and Cher were still, you know, running around at that point. So that's really cool. And Dave, you know, I love Dave. I'm from Indiana originally, so he's sort of like one of our heroes there. And Midwestern, you know, they're all from the Midwest, and Midwestern people have very solid, dry, sarcastic sense of humor, and they're prickly. So that's probably why they all got along.
Yes, they always had in their segments together, which you can find a lot of. I don't know if they're your person. You said you were taping these things on VHS. Somebody was taping them obsessively and has posted not just Siskel and Ebert segments, but so many Letterman segments on YouTube. And there are these compilations of all their appearances on Letterman that you can find on there. And they are so great. And, you know, there's the segments. You can see the first time they ever appeared on Late Night, and you can watch them play basketball to like settle debates, who can score the most free throws to decide who was correct about a movie. They, you know, you can watch them shilling fake products. They never endorsed a single actual product with like an actual commercial in their life, even though they were sometimes offered lucrative endorsement deals that they turned down. But when Dave would ask them to do a fake commercial on the show, they would do it. There's trailer parodies they're in, all kinds of great stuff. I did ask one of the producers that I spoke to for the show, like, did they ever turn down an idea? Did like that was too crass or too silly or too? They're like, no, never. And in fact, the sillier it was, the better the more they wanted to do it, and the more they would fight over who got to do the best parts, like who was going to get the punchlines, who was going to get to be funny. They would fight about that. I mean, they fought about everything, but so that doesn't surprise me at all. But yeah, they would relish the opportunity to do fun stuff on Letterman, especially.
That's awesome. Well, now I know how I'm going to spend my weekend. I'm going to be diving into that. Like I need another time waster, but it'll be nostalgic. So I'll probably remember, you know, seeing it for the first time. So that'll be fun. Definitely going to check out some YouTube. That's the nice thing about living in today land. You can revisit everything. Instead, just have to remember. Official question number two, you can kind of see how this goes. I ask a ton of questions. The tagline of the book is How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. And I just love that. So through your research, which clearly you've done a ton of just in this little bit we've been talking, it sounds like you've been deep diving everywhere. Do you think these very opinionated people knew that they were doing something this groundbreaking that would last forever, that we'd still be talking about it, you and I, today on this show?
They definitely were. They certainly were aware of the impact of the show. And I think they really relished it. I mean, what they liked about that was that they felt that, and they tried often to influence the world of movies, like directly, if they could, you know. And some of that is what the book is about, is the ways in which they tried to nudge things in directions that they wanted them to go. Now, that could take different forms. That might be in terms of, you know, if they found a film or a filmmaker that they thought was really talented, but was maybe under the radar, needed more attention. You know, it wasn't as simple as, well, this movie was good, two thumbs up. They would keep reviewing their movie. They would keep talking about the filmmaker over and over and try to, you know, just keep them in the conversation, in the consciousness. And there are filmmakers that I spoke to for the book who would say that they don't think they would even have a career in filmmaking if not for the show and for Gene and Roger and for the way that they champion them. So that's sort of one way that they absolutely, you know, knew and would try to have an influence. I guess the other way would be sort of more in like a macro sense. You know, when there was an issue that would kind of pop up in the world of film or popular culture, they kind of loved the chance to weigh in on it and maybe even like put their thumb on the scale, in a way, no pun intended, and try to kind of push things in one way or the other. You know, if they saw something that they didn't like, they would find a way to talk about it on the show and criticize it, you know, and try to open the eyes of their viewers to what they saw as a potential problem. An example of that would be something like, you know, the colorization of black and white movies, which thankfully today is almost a non-existent concept. But in the mid and late 80s, that was a big thing that was suddenly on the rise, was these companies had their hands on these libraries of classic movies and were trying to find any way they could to monetize them and exploit them, which that's what they're there to do. Fine. But someone, and I don't know who the first person was, but someone had the bright idea, well, people aren't as into black and white movies anymore. They're resistant to them a little bit, the audience is. So, but if we put color on them, if we artificially add color to these originally black and white movies, we might be able to sell them to television. We might be able to make some more money out of them. And Roger and Gene, actually, they first were like introduced to this concept at one of these syndication conventions where they would have to go and plug their show. And while they were there, someone came up to them and said, come here, we got this amazing thing. We got to show it to you. You got to see this. And they went to a booth where someone showed them a black and white movie that this company had colorized. And they were, you know, proud of themselves for having done this, thinking this was a great thing, they being the company. And Roger and Gene were aghast, and they thought this was a horrible idea. They hated the results, and they really thought it was almost offensive to do this to any movie, to take a director's ideas of their vision and without their permission or authorization or desire to like paint on artificial colors. And so rather than talking about it on their show and saying, you got it, we just saw this, you got to hear about this, they did a whole episode about why this was a bad idea and how this has to be stopped and why it was wrong. And then they also did another episode, sort of the flip side, all about the beauty of black and white movies, celebrating black and white and trying to educate the audience to understand why black and white is great and why it's not missing color. It's just a different form of movies that in its own way is just as, if not more beautiful than color. And so, you know, and within a few years, colorization was not as much of a thing. Now, do I think they single-handedly changed the world of movies in that regard? No. But I absolutely think doing things like that to an audience of millions of people every week who were passionate moviegoers and movie lovers, educating them about why this is not such a good thing, I absolutely think influenced the course of colorization and why that, you know, kind of did fade away. So those are the sorts of ways that they, you know, influenced the world of movies. And yeah, I think absolutely tried to influence, you know, I think, and, you know, in terms of would their legacy, did they anticipate it would have lasted today? That I don't know. But I think even, I mean, certainly by the end of Roger's life, he knew the influence he had on people like me, because people like me were telling him quite often. So, and I think I'm pretty sure he liked that a lot. He liked the fact that the show had inspired so many people to become movie makers and movie lovers and movie critics. And he would often, you know, encourage those people when they would contact him, or if he read someone he really liked online, he would invite them to contribute to his blog or his website. So, yeah, I can't say for certain they could have predicted that someone would make this book, or that they would still be talked about. But I don't know that they would be entirely shocked.
Yeah, they had a very important voice in the community. And, you know, that's a really good example with the colorization. I remember that, and it was very jarring. I remember being very jarred by that and offended. That's a good
It was
word.
Hideous. I mean, it looked terrible. I mean, it wasn't a great idea, and it was badly executed. And I certainly am not upset that it went the way of the dodo. I guess maybe you can still find colorized movies out there, and perhaps now with technology, maybe you could do it better. But certainly in the mid 80s, it was terrible.
Mm-hmm. I do remember that. I do remember that. And my sister and I were both very huge fans of like the noir, you know, the golden age of noir movies. And it's like, no, no, please no. But yeah, it's so cool that they had that influence, that you've enlightened us there, because I do. It's it. Cause you know, everyone just starts out where they start out as movie critics, and then they grew into this huge impact. They had a lot of impact. So it's really awesome that you've highlighted that for us. So thanks. It sounds to me, I don't know you at all, but it sounds to me you're pretty obsessive when it comes to the facts, because just the few answers that you've already let us know about. How much research did you put into the writing? And what is the one thing that surprised you? It seems like you've been immersed in this world for a long time. Was there anything during the research that surprised you?
Yeah, nothing surprised me, because I was such a dork already. No, I mean, there definitely was a lot of research, even though, you know, in some ways the research was the last 30 years of my life in some shape or form. But I did, you know, obviously I spoke to as many people as I could about them, who worked with them, who knew them, and getting their perspectives on them, and also, you know, filmmakers and people like that whose lives and careers were, you know, influenced by them. A lot of research online, a lot of research in archives, you know, going through clippings, and because, you know, unfortunately, Siskel and Ebert are no longer with us. And so, you know, I did want to, as much as possible, have their voices in the book. And so that really required a lot of, like, going through old interviews, old profiles, things like that, to find them talking about themselves, the relationships that they had, their show, wherever I could. And so that was a lot of the nuts and bolts of research. And then, yeah, there was a lot of watching and rewatching the show, which definitely was, for me, was the most fun part, because I had given myself the excuse and really the requirement to watch hundreds of episodes of Siskel and Ebert, which is a wonderful gift to give yourself when it's one of your favorite shows. And so I got to go, you know, I tried my best to watch every episode that I could that's out there. And the vast majority are out there. There's some episodes that are, at least as I was doing this, weren't online or I couldn't find. But I tried to watch everyone that I could find, watch basically in chronological order. So I could watch the show evolve. I could watch the world of movies evolve around the show, which was a big part of it. Seeing, you know, sort of some of the stuff we already talked about, like seeing colorization appear, seeing them talk about it, and then seeing it kind of recede, and seeing what the next issue that would be on their minds would be. So the surprises were things like that. It was like, you know, what were the movies in the summer of 1991, and what was on people's minds who loved movies in the summer of 1991, and what was the controversy that month, and, you know, like, why did Siskel and Ebert get banned from Fox Movies briefly, seeing movies released by the Fox studio? You know, like, I didn't really remember that story, if I ever knew that story. And so reading about that was a surprise, and how that all resolved very quickly, with Siskel and Ebert being quickly reinstated. Spoiler alert, their banning did not last even a single movie. The Fox decided that it was worth it to hopefully get two thumbs up from them on whatever their next movie was, that it wasn't worth banning them from seeing something else because they might give it a negative review, which was basically the gist of why they were banned in the first place. They had been making jokes about Nuns on the Run, I believe, was the movie. And Fox was not happy that they were cracking jokes, I think, on Regis and Kathy Lee about their movie and said, that's it, you're banned. And they said, that's fine. We'll go see your movies in a theater. We'll pay $8 or whatever it was at the time. And we'll just review it that way. We don't care. And they got a lot of publicity about that. And the next time Fox had a movie that came out, I think it was Gene who called them and said, hey, are we still banned? We want to go see the movie. And they said, you can come. It's okay. Just come see it. Yeah, review it. And so, yeah, the ban didn't even last a single movie. So most of the surprises were really like things like that. It was, and maybe this is just my personal interest and bias as a film critic, film lover, just learning little stuff about that, about the world of movies between 1975 and 1999 when the show began and ended. It was a great like re-education or a deeper education about the world of cinema during that period. And there was a lot of surprises like that in there to find.
That is so cool. I mean, I wish I could have done all that with you because I'm going to have to do a version of that.
People can go down that YouTube rabbit hole. Now, you may not want to go down as deep as I did. I don't know that I would advise that if you want to maintain healthy social relationships and jobs, professional commitments. But I do, like I said, you know, people ask about, like, was it hard watching hundreds of episodes? No, it was great. I loved it. I loved every minute of it. I was kind of sad when I got to the end because then I had to actually, like, write something. And that was the hard part. But you don't even have to do that. You know, I think if you're interested in a specific movie, you could just look up a movie from that period and find that review or find the whole episode that review was on. And you might be surprised by the other movies that came out the same week. You might be surprised by the review that they gave. Maybe they really liked a movie that we now think of as a piece of junk, or maybe they hated a movie that now we consider a classic of that era. There's every episode there was something like that. It was always interesting to see what's going to happen next. What are they going to talk about next? What are they going to like next? What are they going to hate next? What movie have I never heard of that they say is a masterpiece that I have to go track down, which I would do. And that was how the appendix of the book came about. You know, the appendix in my book is 25 movies that they loved that didn't become Pulp Fiction and Hoop Dreams and these famous iconic classics of that era. And it's the movies that I discovered watching the show for the book and really was amazed by and was delighted by and surprised by. And they gave them all two thumbs up. And for whatever reason, they didn't become the classics of that era. But they're all 25 really interesting, fun, exciting, insightful, sometimes scary, suspenseful, whatever they are. They're like, they run the gamut, the types of movies that are in there. But, those were the sorts of discoveries. And I decided, yeah, let's put some of them in the book. Let's get some film criticism in this book about film critics. And hopefully people check out the book. They will definitely look at that appendix and maybe find some things that they haven't seen that they want to check out. That would be, I know for me, that would be one of the best things. The best outcomes is if people told me, yeah, I like the book, but what I really liked was I also discovered The Plot Against Harry or The Silent Partner or, you know, one of these movies that's covered in that appendix that they hadn't heard of or hadn't seen before and then watched and really liked.
Absolutely. Well, it's funny because I think we would, because I'm a little bit obsessive, I think, as you, it seems like you are a little bit too. When I did not go to film school, I became an English major because I wanted to be a writer, but I thought I'd give myself my own film school. So I just made a spreadsheet and I watched every movie from 1970, and I still keep it up today. Anything that's been nominated for like a major award, the foreign awards, foreign films. So I could, because I didn't like being in a conversation when I was living in New York, a lot of people talk about film all the time. And I didn't like being in a conversation where they'd reference a classic movie that I didn't know anything about. So I just made it my business to watch all of these movies on a spreadsheet. So I tell people that and they're like, okay, are you okay? Because I need to have it all I need to be complete. I'm a completist person. I need to have all it done. So my fourth question you've already basically answered, because I was going to ask you about the evolution of the show. And we touched on that. And that was really wonderful and enlightening. And then you almost started answering my fifth question, which is No, because I think we're just vibing, because, you know, we feel the same way about the show. Because I mean, I'm a huge fan. I am going to revisit now because this is very inspiring to me. But I was wondering if there was anything Well, the fifth question is actually not that, but I did want to ask you, I'll switch out my fourth one. So is there a movie that you think that you really loved that they hated, or do you think they ever got anything really wrong? Is there anything that they
I mean, yes, there are quite a few. I mean, while I was watching the show, that would happen sometimes. And, you know, I was one of the things I was taking notes on, and I have, you know, like unbelievably extensive notes about the history of the show that I would take while I was watching. And one of the, I would keep these lists of, you know, the movies they loved that they got, quote unquote, got right, you know, movies that we now consider these classic films. And then there was a list of the movies they, quote unquote, got wrong. And sometimes it would be one or the other, you know, Roger Ebert gave thumbs down to Die Hard, you know, that sort of thing. And sometimes it would be both of them. So like an example of that, you know, a movie that I really like that got two thumbs down is Beetlejuice, Tim Burton's Beetlejuice. Which I just revisited recently, holds up really well, is a funny movie, is visually imaginative, has great characters, great production design, it's funny, just, you know, they gave it two thumbs down. They were not big fans of Tim Burton, especially like in his early career. They also gave two thumbs down, I believe, to Edward Scissorhands. So yeah, they were very skeptical about him, at least in the beginning. So, I mean, that's just, yeah, one example. You know, when you're reviewing thousands of movies over the years, like you're bound to disagree with the consensus. So this is not like a knock on them by any stretch of the imagination that they disagreed. And like I said, like it's in a way it's good. Like what would be the purpose of a show where everyone agreed and they always found the consensus, right? Like part of the pleasure of Siskel and Ebert was that, you know, they disagreed so often, you know, they agreed a lot of the time, especially about the movies that we now consider great movies. But every so often, even about a great movie, they would fight over it. And it was just this reminder that consensus is fine, but discussion is great. And, you know, movies are subjective. Art is subjective. You do not have to think that, you know, just because I think Die Hard is great, who am I to tell Roger Ebert he was wrong about not liking it? Of course, if he didn't like it, that's his opinion. And the honesty with which they presented those opinions was another key to the show, is that whether you agree or disagree with their reviews about anything, and sometimes I would find myself disagreeing, I never for one second think, oh, well, they don't really believe that. They're just saying that to get a reaction or to please the studio or to make someone happy. No, I mean, if they say they didn't like it or they say they like it, you believe it was the truth. It was their honest opinion. It was their authentic takes. And that's why the audience so trusted them and loved them, is because they knew if they were watching the show, they were going to get their genuine reactions, even if their reactions went against the consensus. Even if everyone else on the planet loves Die Hard, Roger wasn't going to be shy and say, oh, I guess I liked it too. No, absolutely not. He was going to say, I didn't like it, and here is why, and this is what's bad about it. And, you know, I think that's really valid and valuable to have.
I agree. And I think that's what the most fun thing about discussing books, movies, anything, art, is, you know, a differing of opinion. And we're all like, oh, it's great. Then what's the point of that? You know, that it's just more stimulating to discuss. I mean, that, you know, you go on Amazon and see 1-star reviews for The Great Gatsby. It's like, okay, well, that person hated that. You
know? Absolutely. So
it's going to be a thing. It's the fifth question. So they feel like, to me, I mean, I'm 52 and they were for part of my childhood, essentially. So they've been, it's just, they're an iconic set of gentlemen that did this iconic breakthrough thing for us film nerds. I'm a proud nerd as well. I will say that word out loud. Is there anything out there? And you are so well-versed in this world. Like, you know, you're a film critic, you're an award-winning editor, person that knows all about this. So what is today's thing? Is there anything out there today in our current media as it relates to movie critique and journalism that you think is comparable to them? Or is it they started this and now it's better? Or, I mean, I remember when IMDb came out, I was like, thank God, now I know where to go to find stuff. So where can we go? What do you recommend us to do?
Well, yeah, I mean, I just imagine for people listening who are younger, like a world of how they had to do this show without IMDb. Imagine you had to figure out how to spell names or pronounce names or remember the third movie they made before the movie they were reviewing. One of the producers talked about how she like kind of had to carry like encyclopedias and books with her, like in a like a briefcase almost, so that when there were questions like that that would come up, they could turn to them to have the answers handy, because there wasn't an IMDb that had all that information. It really was a totally different world. In terms of like what I look to today, I mean, yeah, there really isn't on television a show like Siskel and Ebert, at least about movies. Certainly, you look around the cable dial and you find a lot of shows that are reminiscent of their vibe about different topics, about sports, about politics. But in terms of a movie show like that, there really isn't. I think where you find what I think of as kind of like the evolution of the Siskel and Ebert format is like podcasts, and which I am a great fan of and used to host in the past myself. And I mean, what they are different, though, you know, like they aren't the same as Siskel and Ebert in a few different ways. For one thing, they're generally a lot longer. Because Siskel and Ebert was a 28 or 22 minute TV show where these guys had to cover like four or five movies in that time. So the reviews were short and they had to be very concise, which is a skill unto itself, being that, you know, being that concise and getting a point across and being interesting and insightful and funny and entertaining in that time is not easy to do. A podcast can go on as long as the person wants, as long as the conversation is going. I listen to some film podcasts that are 2-3 hours long about a single movie. The movie is 90 minutes. The conversation is 3 hours. So it's different in that sense. And the other big difference is, you know, at least of the podcasts I listen to and I like and I'm familiar with, the people on these podcasts who are kind of doing the Siskel and Ebert model, they want to be there. They want to be talking to each other. They're longtime friends. They're longtime colleagues. They'd be talking whether the microphones were there or not. This is kind of like, you know, the good ones, you feel like you're eavesdropping on a great conversation between longtime friends, you know. That wasn't really the vibe of Siskel and Ebert. Yes, they did come to really admire each other, maybe love one another. They liked each other to a certain extent. Their relationship grew and evolved, but they weren't like buddies. And it wasn't like if the show wasn't there, they'd be getting, you know, getting dinner together and chit chatting and mixing it up. I don't know that they ever really had that kind of relationship. So the show thrived on that. You know, that was a different thing. There isn't a podcast that I know, again, that I know of. There's a lot of podcasts. Maybe I'm missing the podcast where someone has put two people who don't like each other and who, you know, love to go at it and fight each other, and they talk about a movie for an hour each week. Maybe that podcast should exist. Maybe somebody should make that podcast. I don't know. But that is kind of the thing that is missing, or one of the things that's missing from these podcasts, which, again, I love a lot of them and I think are in some ways the more kind of evolved version of this because they can go more in depth. But the drama, the thrill of a Siskel and Ebert, the suspense of what are they going to say next? What are they going to fight about next? I'm not sure anything that I've heard in a podcast or on a YouTube channel has, I don't know that I've seen anything lately or heard anything lately that captures that. That's what as a Siskel and Ebert junkie, that's the fix I'm still looking for.
I think that's very apt. And I think you just created your next project. You just got to find someone that you disagree with all the time.
I just have to find someone I hate. Who do I hate?
Well, hopefully it's not me, but
no,
I mean, I can certainly not. I can pretend. No, I'm just kidding. Well, that was your point earlier. They never pretended. They just actually were just themselves. And that's why
No, they were not actors. They were, in fact, when they tried to act, it didn't always, you know, on the occasion, the rare occasion it happened, I don't know that they were that great at it. They weren't actors. They were themselves and they were their authentic selves. And that's what made them great.
That's absolutely. And I think you have to, that you can't recreate that. That's just a thing. So what's next? What's going on with you now? What are you working on?
Talking to people about the book and doing my day job and, you know, thinking about maybe some things I might want to do next. But at this point, there's nothing definitive in the cards. So we'll see. I don't know.
Well, it seemed like this was a pretty exhaustive project, and it's wonderful, and everyone needs to get opposable thumbs. So you probably need to take like a breather and just sort of watch a bunch of movies next, and then think about the next project. But it will. I have a lot of friends that write nonfiction, and it's exhausting when you immerse yourself in this world for years, and then you write something, and you just sort of need to like just write like a rom com or something, like just something very easy.
I mean, not romantic, but there's definitely a kind of a screwball comedy vibe to some of these, their antics, their rivalry, it almost, you could, if you fictionalize this and switched one of their genders, I suppose, or I guess you don't even have to switch the genders, you could just make it a romantic relationship, but the way that they met and hated each other and grew to love each other, I mean, that's like classic romantic comedy meet cute kind of stuff. You could do it, I guess. I mean, that wouldn't be the true story, but it might be a fun fictional story, I suppose.
Absolutely. There's so many ways you could take this. We could spitball all day long about this subject, because they are fascinating men, and you're such a cool guy to sit down and unpack all this for us, so we can really, I mean, for me, it's very nostalgic, and I love reliving this world. It just reminds me of the not the good old days. I think these days are pretty good too when it comes to film, and movies just are sort of a love language for me. I just love movies so much. I'm going tonight with my oldest friend from high school. We're going to go see the Christopher Lee version of Dracula on the big screen.
Nice.
One of those cool, theaters now that have like the drinks and the recliners and things. So we're doing that. And we saw Basic Instinct together. So that's how long we've been.
I think that's another two thumbs down from Siskel and Ebert. So they were not fans of that one either. Another divisive pick.
Yes, and we saw Fatal Attraction too. Did they like Fatal Attraction?
I believe they did. That one's not, at the top of my tongue. It's not coming right to mind. But I believe so. Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's so funny about Basic Instinct. I just rewatched it recently, and it's it is what it is. It's interesting. I can't wait. This is gonna be like my new nerd project. I'm just my new obsessive project. My OCD will be kicking in. I'll just be watching their episodes and then watching the movies. And
it's not a bad way to go about it. I would recommend it.
Yeah, it'd be fun. Thank you so much for spending time with me today. It's been a joy to get to know you and to meet you. You're so funny and interesting. And I just, anybody that's as much into movies as me, I just can't get enough of them. So thank you again. Good luck with everything. Everyone needs to run out and get opposable thumbs. It's awesome. And Matt is such a nice guy.
You don't know that. I might be a jerk. Who knows? Maybe as soon as we hang up, I'll be yelling at someone. But thank you for the very nice things you said. And it was a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, you're just practicing for our new podcast, so we're going to be disagreeing. Have a great day, and good luck with everything.
All right. Thanks so much.